acoustic music. You will hear all festival, but you're not here for that kind of music. You're here for something completely different. Can I just give a few housekeeping announcements just to begin with? Because it goes very quiet, so you turn up the stereo, and then all of a sudden you disappear through the windscreen. So be ready for sharp changes in volume. But will you please welcome Mr. Chris Dingle?
Good morning. I couldn't resist seeing whether the subwoofers could cope with the Notre Dame Cathedral organ there. That is Dieu parmi nous, God is among us. And I should say, by the way, that listening to Messiaen in the car this morning, I twice missed my junctions on the motorway as I was checking through on the example track. So I arrived here a little more harassed than I expected to. I'm here to talk and give some kind of broad brush, and it needs to be very broad brush, introduction to the music of Messiaen, the life of Messiaen, and in particular relate that to his very, very profound faith and belief. He ranks as one of the greatest composers of the 20th century. He ranks as one of the greatest religious artists, the most remarkable religious artists in the whole Western canon. And so what I propose to do is take a broadly chronological approach and try to bring in various examples. We'll listen to all sorts of different bits of music and at the same time try and highlight the spiritual aspect of what Messiaen was trying to do and some of the more straightforward ways in which his faith is reflected in his music. So I think we'll start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. And there are two possible beginnings we could start with, but we'll start with his beginning as a human being rather than his beginnings as a composer. Messiaen said on many occasions, "I was born a believer." A very typical kind of ex-cathedra statement from Messiaen, which actually requires a little bit of unpicking, and when you do unpick it, what he means is that he always had an awareness of his faith, despite the fact that certainly when he was growing up his parents were not particularly religious. His mother was not a believer at all. His father was, but was, shall we say, lapsed during the time that Messiaen was being brought up. And so he cites this almost as a sort of mystical thing. He always had a profound faith that developed during the usual upbringing of a French boy in the country, and despite not being believers, because it was a thing that you did at the turn of the century, his parents still took him to church, he was baptized, he went to catechism lessons and things like that, but he was always aware of the wondrous aspects of his faith. And he was also always aware of the supernatural. He had a great love of fairy tales. He had a great love of all the more remarkable things in Shakespeare and other bits of literature. He loved quite a lot of English literature because his father was a translator of English literature, translated the whole of Shakespeare and Milton and all sorts of other people. Despite this, Messiaen spoke not a word of English. And his mother was a poet, and he was greeted into the world with a collection of poems called L'âme en bourgeon, the budding soul, written while she was expecting Messiaen. And if you have a tendency to believe in predestination, if you have a sense of the wondrous, then to be told around about 8 or 9 that this collection of poems was actually written for you. And if you have, if you read through the poems, and certainly he read through the poems, and maybe selectively taking one or two things, decided in later life that his mother had foreseen that he would be a great composer, he would be interested in the Orient, he would be interested in nature in particular. Messiaen more or less taught himself the piano. He really is one of these sickening people that had an incredibly easy facility at all things musical. And I'll say a little bit more about his training after our next extract, which is track 1. This is pretty much the earliest piece of Messiaen that that still exists. It's Le Banquet Céleste, an organ work, unsurprisingly for Messiaen, a work on the Blessed Sacrament, and it's a relatively short organ meditation. What's remarkable about it is that as soon as music begins, it seems to have stood still. And from very early on, he has this capacity to think harmonically and think in terms of time in a very different way from composers who had come before him. But a lot of people say that Messiaen's music is all about, you know, there's a lot of stasis and that it's purely about the eternal. In fact, there's something rather more complicated going on there, rather more complex. This piece is actually giving us an idea of movement within stillness, reflecting one of the great divine mysteries, the ability of God to exist without time and yet to operate within time at the same time. So if we could just have track one, please. Now, it's not by chance that my first two examples have been organ works, because one of the things that most people, if they know anything about Messiaen, is that he was an organist. He was the organist at the Trinité in Paris, one of the big Parisian churches, and there's a very long tradition in Paris of organist composers. And Messiaen gained his post at Saint-Trinité when he was just 22 years old. And these posts are like gold dust. Once you get one, you've basically got the job for life. Messiaen's own teacher, Marcel Dupré, didn't get one of these posts until 3 years after Messiaen. And Messiaen held this post at the Trinité until his death in 1992. He got it in 1931. So a remarkably long period to... this is more than just parish organist. There's a supplementary organist, but this is more than just playing hymns at a mass, because the... one of the primary functions of these organists is also to improvise during the course of the Mass. In fact, during the course of four Masses each Sunday, Messiaen played at. And he would improvise for great lengths of time on the scripture of the day, on the plain chant of the day, and also improvise in between the services using different types of music, not just his own music, but also other people's music as well. And Messiaen wrote an awful lot of organ music as well. The sickening thing, and I don't know if we have any organists here, is that the first time Messiaen ever even looked at an organ console, he was 18 years old. He had no intention at all to be an organist. So thinking that he started off as an organist and then started composing religious works for the concert hall is actually the wrong way around. He always intended to be a composer for the concert hall, writing religious works for the concert hall, and in fact, the organ music was an add-on. He went and visited Marcel Dupré because his piano teacher had said he's very good at improvisation. Dupré recalled later that he sat stupefied in front of the organ console, and Dupré spent a couple of hours explaining to Messiaen how it worked, sent him away with the Bach C minor fugue, and Messiaen came back a few days later having memorized it and worked out registrations and everything like that. And as I say, 4 years later, he gained his premier prix in the Paris Conservatoire organ class and one of these titulaire posts. Having gained his post at the Trinité, actually what he then composed for the next few years were orchestral works, chamber works, vocal works. And in particular, it's the orchestral works that matter. He really regarded himself primarily as an orchestral composer. He didn't want his music just to be in church. And in fact, he wrote really no liturgical music. What Messiaen was far more interested in was sacralizing secular spaces, bringing the message of his faith into the secular concert hall and taking his music to people who wouldn't necessarily come into church. So if we could now have a listen to, if I can get the right sheet of paper, if I can listen to track 3, which is actually from his first orchestral work and is an orchestral meditation. Note the word meditation here. It's Les Offrandes Oubliées, the Forgotten Offerings. And we're going to pick it up. It's in three parts. We're going to pick it up towards the end of the first part. And like Le Banquet Céleste, this is very slow. Much when Messiaen writes slow on a score, he doesn't mean fairly slow. He means slow. So we'll just have a listen to this. A meditation isn't just something quiet and in the background for Messiaen. When Messiaen writes music for meditation, it is not music to be ignored. It is not wallpaper music. The music is the meditation. The music is the focus and the message of it. He usually has biblical inscriptions, bits from theologians in his program notes, and these are very much part of the music. The music is, if you like, the equivalent of an icon. It is something where that is what you are focusing on. The way Messiaen characterized it was, he said, "My music is not nice, it is truthful." And if people have problems with some of the more what they would call dissonant aspects, then they should read the Bible. It is not a nice book, it is a truthful book. So, in contrast to a lot of religious music, and I'm using the term in a very broad sense there, including music written by composers, you know, sort of every 19th century composer had to write a requiem at some point, and most of the best ones were written by agnostic or atheist composers. But Messiaen's music was very much from a point of view of contemplating scripture first. He also, as a young man, very much wanted to bring in his family into his music. And he married a violinist and composer, Claire Delbus, fairly early on, and wrote several song cycles for her. He originally started trying to write violin works for her and then realized that it was quite difficult to write showpiece violin works which also have a religious message. So he started writing song cycles, Poem pour Mi. Mi was his pet name for Claire Delbos, which is a celebration of their marriage. Chant de Terre et de Ciel, Songs of Heaven and Earth, which is does what it says on the tin, but is also very much about family life and about his son as well. And later on, Harari, which is a slightly different case, but is again a big song of love. And Claire Delbos is the second of the very important women in Messiaen's life. The first was his mother, the second was Claire Delbos, his first wife, who he was deeply, deeply, deeply in love with and remained deeply in love with until she died in 1959. And there's it's a very tragic story around her, because from the mid-1940s onwards, she started getting early signs of, well, shall we say, mental problems. It eventually, after about 10 years, was diagnosed as a brain illness, something rather similar to mad cow's disease, actually. And it was a very long, slow, painful decay. And from the late 1940s onwards, you get Messiaen having to deal with the fact that he's losing the person that he loved, and yet, that is in the kind of mental sense, but physically she is still alive. And there's this great, big, long, drawn-out grieving process, if you like. And there's another factor that comes in at this point as well. During the war, Messiaen was, as all young Frenchmen were, was called up as a soldier. He'd done his national service, and so he was then conscripted into the army. They'd learned from his national service that he shouldn't be let anywhere near guns because he was a hopelessly impractical man. And so he started off helping to dig trenches, and then he was a stretcher bearer, basically. And along with 30,000 others, he got rounded up when the Germans invaded and was put in a prisoner of war camp. And we'll hear more about that with the quartet for the end of time later. But when he ended up back in Paris, having been repatriated, he started working at the Paris Conservatoire. He's one of the great musical pedagogues of any age. And one of the first students that he had was a remarkable young pianist called Yvonne Loriot. She was 16 when he first met her, and she already had a quite remarkable repertoire. Yes, like countless other pianists at the Paris Conservatoire, she could play all of the Beethoven sonatas, all of Mozart's sonatas, and everything like that, lots of Fauré. But she also had all of Debussy, she could play lots of Bartok, she could play Jolivet, and she also played some of Messiaen's music. This was very, very, very new music at the time. And to give you an idea of how good she was asked to give the French premiere of Bartok's Second Piano Concerto, which is no easy piece, at a few days' notice, because several other pianists had been asked to do it and, after working on it, had decided that there was no way they could possibly play this piece. It was way too difficult. She gave the premiere on just a few days' notice, and apparently it was a fantastic performance. We'll hear a little bit of an indication of her pianism from one of the works that she inspired in the 1940s, Regard sur l'Enfant Jésus. Regard is one of these difficult French words that doesn't quite translate, but it looks at, gazes at, contemplations of the child Jesus. And this is the Regard de Joie, the Regard of Joy. And it's sort of marks the midpoint of the piece. We're just going to hear the opening of it just to give a tiny flavour of Loriot's ability at the piano. This is track 10. This is a very rare recording. It's from a 78 that she recorded in 1947. That I eventually tracked down after a very long time last year. So track 10, please. Now, Loriot very quickly became a kind of muse for Messiaen in the purely musical sense, and we get a whole string of pieces all involving piano. And pretty much, by far the majority of his works from the mid-1940s onwards include piano, whether they are piano works or whether they are orchestral works, whatever it might be, there is usually a piano involved, and usually a very, very, very difficult piano work. Because Messiaen said, it liberated everything. It didn't matter what you threw at her, she could play it. And that's incredibly liberating for a composer, especially someone like Messiaen. So first of all, we get these three big religious cycles: Vision de l'âme for two pianos, Regard sur l'Enfant Jésus, and then three little liturgies of the Divine Presence, which is a kind of cantata, if you like, for women's voices, piano solo, and martino solo, and strings and lots of percussion. A quite exotic piece. Not surprisingly, Messiaen also begins to fall in love with Loriot in kind of inverse proportion to the decline in his wife's health. Now, a few years ago, I was asked to write a piece about Messiaen by someone rather well known who shall remain nameless, but who was basically, all they were interested in was a very late 20th century view of this, a very gossipy view of this, basically, were they having an affair? Did they or didn't they? And that's all this person was interested about, completely missing the fact that as a man of profound faith and just on any kind of human factor, this was a very, very difficult and tragic circumstance. A tremendously ill wife who he loved tremendously, and this extraordinary young pianist who he was also becoming increasingly fond of. And how Messiaen wrestled with that, and of course, he had no idea how long his wife's illness was going to go on for. He still harboured hopes that she would recover right into the 1950s. He would take her violin along to her in the nursing home where she was, hoping that that would bring something out of her. Sadly, it didn't. So it's actually a very tragic circumstance. And Messiaen reacted to that in three different ways. First of all, by going into a kind of surrealist phase and exploring ideas associated with the Tristan myth, love, death. Love that can only be achieved and through death. A love so great that death is the ultimate outcome. Now, of course, with a dying wife or a seriously ill wife, the only place they could be together were in their dreams, effectively. And also there is, of course, an analogy there, a religious analogy, in terms of, you know, someone who had such great love for us that it was expressed in his, ultimately in his death. So even when Messiaen is not being explicitly religious, there's an implicit religious focus there. After this, there's a second phase where Messiaen, uncharacteristically for him, started going for rather abstract works. This was partly a reflection of his pupils, but also, I think, trying to escape from the grim reality of life at the time. But this didn't last very long because, basically, fundamentally, Messiaen's music is always about something. He never lost his belief in music's ability to portray. And so his way forward, his way being able to compose and to regain his fluidity, if you like, was to turn to nature. And in particular, to birdsong. He had a great love of birdsong. And from the mid-1940s onwards, every single work that Messiaen composed included transcribed birdsong. For him, birds were the first musicians on the planet. He stated that many times. I have no idea what his evidence was for that, but he stated that birds were the first musicians. He regarded them as God's musicians, called them these little servants of immaterial joy, and analogous to angels. But also that all music effectively came from birds, so it's a purer kind of music. But it also gave him a new source of melody that was that could stand up to the scrutiny of people like Pierre Boulez, who preferred Messiaen to go for what he called the more anarchic intervals. Now then, I have a little friend here. This is a golden oriole. And I don't know if you could all hear that. Should I do that again? That is a genuine golden oriole's bird call. Messiaen would get up very, very early, go out into the woods, take drives into the woods, and listen to birds. And unlike previous composers with birdsong, what he was trying to do was actually listen to the birds, and rather than give an allegory for the birds, listen to what they actually sounded like. And we'll hear in a moment, it's going to be track 20, one of the pieces from his cycle Catalogue d'Oiseaux, Catalogue of Birds, which is actually the most misplaced title that I can think of, because it gives a very kind of dry impression of what's going on in what is actually a very colourful and dramatic piece. It's the second piece, Le Loriot, the Golden Oriole. Loriot with a T at the end rather than a D, but quite obviously an allusion also to Yvonne Loriot, who is the pianist this was written for. And so we'll just hear the very opening of this. You'll hear chords which are depicting the first glimmers of sunrise, and then you'll hear the Golden Oriole's song. Now, of course, Messiaen's birds also sound like Messiaen, just as the same way that when if you have Picasso paint a dove and if you have Matisse paint a dove, both pictures look like a dove, and one looks like Picasso and the other looks like Matisse. It also has his own personality in there. But there is a very definite focus on what the bird itself sounds like. Now, I'm rattling forward here to try and get through to the last part of his life, which in some ways is, from the religious point of view, is one of the more interesting ones, because this is where Messiaen begins to bring everything back together. After the death of his first wife in 1959, not surprisingly, you can feel the weight coming off of Messiaen's shoulders, and he feels more able to go out effectively and proselytize again. So from the mid-1960s onwards, we start getting these huge monuments in which he brings together all the different aspects of his music. We had this very rich harmonic music in the 1940s. There was the experimental music from the early 50s. There's the bird song. He brings it all together and adds other things. He's bringing together the whole of his creation to try and depict the entirety of God's creation. And the last few examples are just to give some of the flavours of the way in which he does that. So the first one is from a work called The Transfiguration of Our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, you know, to start off with, in the middle of the 60s, a work called The Transfiguration of Our Lord Jesus Christ is not quite what most people are expecting from a contemporary composer. It's a 90-minute oratorio, and let me just check which track we're looking for here. It's we're going to listen to track 22. This is the end of the oratorio, Tota Trinitas Apparet, the whole Trinity appeared. And this is very much the dazzling glory of God. Messiaen used the analogy of a stained glass window. That is, music primarily like a stained glass window. First of all, you're just dazzled by it. It's only as you get closer that you might be able to pick out the details, but the important thing is the dazzling, the ebloissement of the music. So if we could have track 22, please. It's music which is intended almost to kind of pound you into submission. It is huge, it's granitic, it's monumental, it's music of mountains, music of vast spaces. Messiaen also has in these works an idea of, quite apart from the glory of God, something he calls the holy terror, which I know sounds a bit like kind of holy terror Batman, but is more to do with this idea of the awesomeness of God and the fact of this is something which is beyond our comprehension, something that if we come into contact with the reality of God, it is going to be frightening. It is going to be seriously frightening. But he always juxtaposes that with tenderness as well. So if we could have a listen to, this is a moment from his opera, St. Francis of Assisi, which is, unsurprisingly, a vast work. It's 4.5 hours of music and uses an enormous orchestra. We're going to listen to the moment at which the stigmata are inflicted upon St. Francis. Again, let's just pause for a moment and think, this is a contemporary composer in this supposedly atheistic age with a commission for the Paris Opera, the bastion of secular arts, if you like, depicting the stigmata on stage in an opera house. But you will hear the chorus, which represents the voice of God. Then you will hear this orchestral pounding, which is the onrush of grace. And then you will hear the chorus again calling to Francis. So this is track 33. Again, not nice, truthful would be Messiaen's response to that. These are the wounds of Christ being inflicted upon St. Francis. That is not a nice subject, but it is a subject that is very much bound up with ideas of communion and all sorts of complex theology. And there is an awful lot of theology in Messiaen's music, which I won't even pretend that I'm in a position to try and explain now. Ultimately, though, with Messiaen's music, as I say, it's this dazzlement, this ebloissement, and the idea that you might be that you can just sit back and be charmed by the music. It's, on the one hand, some people have problems, complain about the dissonance in it. Other people complain about some of the more straightforward moments in it, depending on where they're coming from on the musical spectrum. Messiaen's viewpoint was that all of God's creation is legitimate and all of God's creation ought to go into a piece of music. There's nothing that should be excluded. And so I'm going to leave you with one of the other things that he liked to depict, which was the celestial kingdom itself. Nothing less than heaven. I mean, that's, he certainly didn't lack in ambition in what he was trying to do. And this is from the end of a piece called Des Canyons aux Étoiles, From the Canyons to the Stars. It was written for the American Bicentenary and was inspired not by the skyscrapers of New York, but by the canyons in Utah and places like that. And if you like, I mean, the abyss is a theme that runs through Messiaen's music. But for him, to misquote Oscar Wilde, you know, we're all in the abyss, but some of us are looking at the heavens. This is the final, the very end of Des Canyons aux Étoiles, called Zion Park and the Celestial City. It's going to be track 28. And it's richly vibrant. It's also a remarkable piece of orchestration because there's actually only, you're only hearing 40 instrumentalists, but it sounds like a vast orchestra. There's only 12 strings playing, but it's this rich, vibrant, colourful and expression of Messiaen's joy and love of his faith. I don't think I can top that, so I shan't try, but I think we do have some time for questions, if anybody has any. Thank you.
Yeah. I understand that Messiaen saw music in its colours and patterns. How important do you think that is in terms of what he writes?
Messiaen, this was asking about... basically about Messiaen's synesthesia. He saw colours whenever he heard music. And, I mean, the jury is slightly out as to what the nature of his synesthesia was. That's basically because we don't really understand much about synesthesia, and Messiaen wasn't sure himself if he was truly synesthetic. There aren't too many synesthetes who have Messiaen's musical sensibilities, so it's rather difficult to make judgments about these things. But colour was fundamentally important to him, and... in particular, he loved the passages in Revelations which talked about the various, you know, sapphires and emeralds and this, that, and the other, and would try to represent that in his music. But again, this analogy of stained glass windows is very important, the dazzling of that. But also using colour symbolically. So his last work, Ecclesia L'Odelà, it starts in... E major, effectively, and ends in A major, and the one colour is a reddishness for Messiaen, and the other colour is a bluishness for Messiaen, and these are two different aspects. These are colours which traditionally are used as to represent the glory and the sort of heavenly nature of God and the kind of humanity of God. And Messiaen also sort of adds to the symbolism by having one movement is wind instruments and the other movement is string instruments, and both movements are about Christ. And effectively, it's a kind of alpha and omega, the idea that everything is included in there. So he uses colour symbolically quite a lot as well, yes.